Welcome to the Digital Irish Podcast, where innovation meets heritage and global impact is the name of the game. I'm Dave Byrne, your host on this journey through the stories of Irish innovators, entrepreneurs, and creators who are having an incredible mark on the world stage. In a landscape dotted with brilliant minds, we're here to spotlight the trailblazers who have taken the essence of Ireland's rich culture and merged it seamlessly with cutting-edge ideas. Each episode, we'll dive into conversations with remarkable individuals, exploring their journeys, challenges, and triumphs. Whether it's in tech, business, or any field where passion meets progress, we're here to showcase the incredible talent that Irish visionaries bring to the world. If you know anything about me, or if you have listened to the podcast repeatedly before, you'll probably know that I am a storyteller. I love being able to engage, connect with others. So every time I have a chance to speak to another storyteller, I get very excited because I always find that I learn something new, I help develop my own skills, and I'm able to understand a little bit more about the art of storytelling itself and the skills behind it. That's why I really enjoyed my time with Jack Murray, who's our guest for today's podcast. Now, Jack is a born storyteller. You can really hear it as he tells some of the stories, as he speaks through his journey from his youth in Ireland to establishing Media HQ. And he also talks about the actual frameworks behind storytelling and how he helps businesses that engage with Media HQ understand those frameworks and build upon those frameworks. So this was, for me, a great way to kick off the new year because, you know, it's a topic that's near and dear to my heart. So what better way to start the new year? And I now I'm just going to drop you straight in the interview. Jack, firstly, thank you so much for taking out the time to talk to us on the podcast today. You yourself are a very passionate storyteller. Where did you find this passion? How did you find yourself becoming passionate about storytelling?
I grew up in a small town in the west of Ireland called Ballinasloe. And I was 50 a few weeks ago. And I still marvel at, you know, we all think the community that we grow up in is the epicenter of the world. And in 1980s, 70s and 80s, the west of Ireland, a lot of the towns, a lot of industry, a lot of bustle. And I grew up in a family business. And it was a very busy place where, you know, we were thrust into the world of business very early. We'd be, you know, it was pre-Facebook, pre-social media. And I joke with people now and joke with my kids that the social network, the TikTok then was, you'd come home from school, you'd eat your dinner as quick as you could, and you'd run out to the shop to see what happened during the day. And the whole community would come in, and it's what was called a general merchants, and selling farm supplies. And we had a grocery shop then as well. And I suppose what got me hooked in storytelling first was, you know, I was born in 1973, but the business was started in the 1880s, and it was the genesis of the business where, you know, my family kind of think in kind of multi-generational terms, which is kind of interesting in that my great-grandfather was one of 8 or 9 children. He grew up in South Roscommon. And at a certain point in the late 1880s, his family were small, you know, Irish farmers on a land holding of about 27 acres. And they were very tight on money, and it looked like they may be evicted by the landlord. They obviously had a family meeting, and someone said, someone's going to need to do something because we're going to be chucked off this land. And at 29 years of age, my great-grandfather said, I'll do something. And the records show that he went to Cove, and, you know, he arrived in into New York on Palm Sunday, the 14th of April, 1886. And anybody who would have seen Gangs in New York, the melting pot that was New York in 1886, everything that it is today, multicultural hub, But with all of the violence, the gangs, the disease, like if the gangs didn't get you, the disease just might. And there's all sorts of folklore and fables in our family as to what he did while he was there, and stories that he was kind of moonshining, or, you know, he was running whiskey and doing stuff like that. But what we do know is that he got a business idea there for a general store, and miraculously he came back. So if you think of, you know, I often see people bubble up now in American politics and they'll say, oh, my great-grandfather moved to America in the 1880s. My great-grandfather moved to America in the 1880s, but I'm from the west of Ireland, because he came back and he started this business, which was a trading post on the main street of Banasloe, and then moved it down to kind of on the river bank where it is now. And I suppose that's the story that kind of, you know, lived in my head growing up, and the notion that you can start a business and, you know, decades and decades and decades later, you can still be relevant to a group of people, and the melting pot that is, and the relevance that has. And that's what hooked me originally.
I love that. I mean, it's so interesting that it's almost like a family thing that got ingrained into you, like a little bit of a passion there. But I love the you know, the starting of a family business as well. For you yourself, then, do you think that was what inspired you to start something yourself, or what else do you feel like drove you to?
Yeah, and I think there were a couple of forces. I think, like, you know, we all talk about nurture and nature, and as long as I can remember, I was surrounded by members of my family who were figuring out problems and sorting things out for themselves. So, you know, I firmly believe in a hand up and not a hand out. I firmly believe in the power of human endeavor, and the ability to solve problems. Like, that was all I saw. And it was funny that, like, I would have been a good student, would have, you know, I suppose had the ability to, I was quite sporty, but I liked the books. So, you know, I would have been a good student, and I would have studied, and I would have liked sport. I played rugby and, like, got into cycling, and but I suppose I would have found in secondary school and into, you know, that I was quite frustrated and I didn't know what the cause of it was. I went to university in Limerick to study marketing, and it was a general business degree. You could have done economics, finance. I liked economics. You could do HR or you could do marketing, and I chose marketing. And I kind of realized that when I came out that, like, I was a frustrated creative, and not in the conventional sense. Like, the education system in Ireland is very kind of, it's quite linear, it's quite siloed. You know, creativity is about, you know, art, it's about, you know, it's about all of the kind of visual arts, it's about crafts, it's about all of those sorts of things. But kind of creativity and ideation and the power of an idea and bringing things to life, that sort of creativity isn't embraced really. Well, it wasn't embraced in the education system that I was part of. And I suppose that was the other thing that kind of interested me from an entrepreneurial point of view. And it took me a quite a while. Like, it took me kind of, like, I can remember graduating from university and my first job was in the marketing department of DuBarry Shoes. But I have a vivid memory of my first winter, and I had moved back to work. I was living at home with my parents and working in DuBarry Shoes, but I used to spend my evening times, like, writing short stories on an old 386 computer in the shop at nighttime, just to pass the time, just to pass the time, and like, kind of realizing that, oh, actually you are a creative person, and what you're trying to do here now is find an outlet. And I suppose, you know, entrepreneurship is a great outlet for creativity.
I want to stick on that quote for a second. Like, entrepreneurship is a great outlet for creativity. I really love that. That's the first time I've heard that. So I'm definitely going to steal that one with pride
Yeah.
and say that to others. It's such a fantastic way of looking at it.
Yeah, well, like I love making things, and like I suppose when I went through, I worked in the shoe company, and then when I got frustrated creatively, like I realized that I was in the wrong place in my career. I was kind of 24 years of age. I was living at home with my parents, and as much as I love my parents, you know, when you're 24 years of age, like I used to joke with people, like you need to live in an environment where you can meet strangers in your own kitchen, like so where you have flatmates to bring people around. And I applied for two things. I applied for a news reporter's job in a local radio station, and I applied for a postgraduate course in journalism in what is now TUD in Dublin. And on a fateful day, I had the interview in Dublin first for the postgraduate course. And then I had to drive down to Longford to Shannonside Radio for an interview for the reporter's job. And I got offered the course. I didn't get the job, but it was funny. They hired a guy called Fran McNulty. And Fran McNulty is a very preeminent broadcast journalist in Ireland to this day. He's an anchor on Prime Time, which is like one of our biggest current affairs programs. And I still joke with the guy who was doing the hiring that day that he definitely picked the right guy, not picking me. But I start I left the marketing job to go work in this or to go to this postgraduate course in journalism. And I suppose the really powerful thing was that when your energies are in sync with the world, it's a brilliant, it's a beautiful place to be. And I have a vivid memory in the first week, we were in the DIT's building in Angel Street in the middle of Dublin, of being in that room and looking around me at people who had English degrees, people who had media degrees, people who'd written for college papers for years, and just realizing that the curiosity I had in me was a superpower, and that actually I had arrived at the right place, that actually this was what I was sent to do. This is the place that was supposed to be. And that's a really nice feeling.
You know, obviously, as you've kind of developed, your storytelling capabilities, like you've obviously developed your own values and storytelling process. I'd love for you to kind of talk us through some of your process.
Yeah, I will. And I suppose, look, just to pick the story up just at that point, I qualified in, like, when I look back in my life at like really brilliant periods, that 12 months I spent in Dublin on that postgrad in journalism was unbelievable for storytelling, for creativity, for, I suppose, my future career. And I kind of realized that for that 12 months I was on the clock, and that, like, you know, a little bit like, you know, evolving into a butterfly at the end of the period, I needed to get to the end of that course and be employable as a journalist. So the college had the best of equipment, and every day I'd go down and buy a copy of the Irish Times, scan the news pages, and there was a community radio station in Dublin on Grafton Street called Ann Olivia. And I went down there one day and I said, "Do you guys need news stories?" And they said, "Oh, we do, yeah." And I said, "Okay, I'll get you news stories." So you'd read a story where a politician was saying something, and you think, "Oh, I'll interview them for the evening news bulletin," and go up, and they had these big mini disc recorders, and you'd go over to Leinster House, and you'd record an interview, drop into Grafton Street with the mini disc, and race home then. And I had a double tape deck, and you'd tape your interview for the evening, on the evening broadcast for your portfolio. And it was just a series of kind of those sort of, you know, those sort of projects that kind of got it going. And I suppose the big break came for me about 6 months after I left university, where I was coming home from a job that I didn't really like, that I'd got when I came out of college in a trade magazine, that was all very dull and boring, and things had got kind of sedate. And I got a call out of the blue from a man called David Quinn, who was the course lead in the journalism course. And he had said that, "Look, I've just got a call from the Progressive Democrats political party, and they're looking for somebody to run their press office, and they've asked me to recommend somebody. And I, if you're okay with it, I'd like to recommend you." And I had myself and David had a great relationship. He ran the course, and we used to go for a coffee once a week and talk about politics. And that's what got me that break. And I suppose getting that job in politics, I skipped about four rungs of the ladder and went in at 25 years of age as the Progressive Democrats were in the government in Ireland, and I was the press officer for the party at 25 years of age. And I went from, you know, working on a trade magazine to dealing with every political editor in the country and setting up press conferences and national conferences and working on general elections. And I suppose that's where I suppose I got my industrial grounding in storytelling. If you work in a political environment, you know, you're dealing on a daily basis with inbound queries, with problems, with issues, with how to communicate with people. And I suppose when I look at it now, like it was in the era just before social media as well. So I, you know, it's a lot more complicated now than it was then. But it was a great grounding. Before I went to work for myself, I left it after 5 years, and my first foray to work for myself was just as a public relations consultant. And that happened one day. I went for coffee with a friend of mine, and he said that he had been doing a little bit of consulting and he was going back into journalism. And he said, I have a couple of clients that are non-aligned. And I said, well, maybe I'd be interested in your clients. And that started me off. And I suppose that was the first foray into working for myself and the precursor to MediaHQ.
Oh, I love that. Okay, great. I mean, that's it's such an interesting, like, you know, there's so much that you've kind of taken on board. There's so much that you've kind of, you know, not only taken from your family experience of like the kind of the joy and passion of storytelling, but also the opportunities that have come along the way and kind of you developing your skills and feeding this passion, feeding this this drive of storytelling. And it all seems to be a culmination of both the work side of things, the personal side of things, really coming to the front where then you jump to create something in Media HQ.
Yeah, and it's funny, like I have a vivid memory of it was I started working in the Progressive Democrats in January of 1999, but I had this wonderful kind of 5 or 6 weeks of a honeymoon period where I joined them in December of 88 and got to do the full round of all the Christmas parties and the drinks parties before I got to do any work. And I can remember being at a drinks party in the Italian room in government buildings, a beautiful opulent room. And somebody introduced me and said, oh, there's someone over here. You're the new guy. They said, there's someone over here you should meet. And they introduced me to this man called Mike Burns. And Mike Burns has this kind of unusual distinction of, I would say, the only person ever to play minor football for Roscommon and to be named on the Queen's Honours List. And Mike was the former London editor of our national broadcaster, RTE, and then went on to do communications for a body called the British Irish Interparliamentary Body. That's what he got his honour for. But Mike was publishing this book called the Irish Media Contacts Directory. And he said to me, oh, young fella, he said, I'll set you up. I'll give you a free copy of the directory. So Mike duly gave me a free copy of the directory. And I remember getting the first copy of the directory thinking, God, this is really cool. And it was just literally like a master key, a book that had the contact details of every journalist in Ireland in it. And I never had it out of my bag. It was always in my bag when I was going places. And fast forward, I suppose, 7 or 8 years later, when I was finished kind of 3 years working for myself as a PR consultant, I approached Mike and I said to him, look, would you ever think of selling the media directory? And he said to me, well, look, I'll be 70 at my next birthday. And he said, I don't want to be doing it any longer than that. So I'll give you the first refusal. And I bought this printed publication, the Irish Media Contacts Directory. And it was, you know, back to the story of kind of growing up, like my dad was a brilliant networker and his name was Joe. And in our business at home, he used to have a tagline, deal with Joe, the man you know. And he always taught me about the power of connecting and networks. So pretty quickly realized that like publishing the book and connecting with people was kind of, you were a guardian of a network of contacts. But we also realized very quickly that, you know, it was a pretty, you know, it was a pretty poor way of keeping up to date with all the media movements. And in the first year, like that kind of hellish kind of print deadline to ostensibly get a phone book right on one day for 30 seconds. And then every other day that year, it would be hopelessly wrong and continuing to get more wrong. And so after about a year, I'd hired somebody to work with me and I said, look, we need to build a digital product that can do this. Something that takes kind of a lot of work off people's table and helps them send press releases and messages to the media. And that was the genesis of Media HQ. And it was kind of formed on this premise based on my experience of working in a in-house team for the Progressive Democrats, that there's a huge amount of grunt and there's a huge amount of difficulty and hard work about building your audience and sharing the story out there. And we wanted to create this piece of technology that removed all the grunt work, that helped professional PR people, so people on in-house teams and PR agencies, to be able to log in, find any journalist they wanted easily, type their story, their press release, their pitch, send it through the software from their own email address, and then get these really insightful reports as to who read it, when they read it, and take that sinking feeling of bounced emails, kind of grunt work, keeping Excel sheets up to date, things not working, not knowing whether anybody had read your pitch or not. Take all that work away. And I suppose, you know, it went from a simple idea to like, you know, quite a substantial piece of software that solves all those problems for people now on a daily basis.
Now, when we're talking about this, because I find this really interesting, because I think a lot of marketers and a lot of people that are working in like communications, they are obviously, a lot of them are natural storytellers, or well, when I say natural storytellers, they are people that have developed their storytelling capabilities. But I think like I've seen too many people that have almost been restricted in how much they can develop their career, because this kind of thing that Media HQ is tackling in regards to almost like the more administrative side of things is a challenge to them, like where they're like, I don't want to pull these reports, I don't want to go through the data, I don't want to figure all of this out. So it seems like you're really lowering the barriers for a lot of storytellers to actually help them understand better the impact of their stories, and then subsequently what they can do to improve upon those stories.
Yeah, and it is funny, like I had a meeting earlier this week for a former journalist who was appointed to head up the communications effort of a well-known Irish and international charity. And this woman was hired for her nous, her new sense, her ability to generate really sharp story angles and communicate the message of this charity out into the world. And her daily life was a series of pain points around bounced emails, Excel spreadsheets, trying to keep up to date with journalists, where the really high value stuff that she needed to be focused on was, look, what is the mission of this organization? Like, what problem are we trying to solve in the world? And then how do we easily build an audience? How do we disseminate that message? How do we create that message first and maybe nuance it for national, for local, for specialized? And then how do we send it out into the world and kind of figure out what has happened? And, you know, we have a database for Ireland and we have one for the UK, and we've been expanding internationally in the last couple of years. But one of my favorite movies is The Big Lebowski. Do you know The Big Lebowski?
I know it very well, yeah.
Yeah, so there's you know, there's so much good stuff in The Big Lebowski, but one of the central concepts is in The Big Lebowski is Jeffrey Lebowski's rug that gets stolen, and the tagline is, you know, I love that rug, it really tied the room together. And I was thinking about, like, the work that we all do as storytellers, as communicators, and I kind of began to study it to see, you know, what was the unifying theory that brought us all together. And the concept that I developed is called the story circle. And the story circle is a kind of a unifying theory that just explains, you know, how everybody who's involved in the business of communicating kind of is tied together. It's very simple. We all start with building an audience. It could be on social media, it could be traditional journalists, it could be customers, it could be key stakeholders. Then we have to create a message. Number three is we send that message out into the world. The fourth thing is we analyzed what happened when we sent that message out into the world. And then the fifth thing is we calibrate and we do it all over again. And in really busy environments, this circle kind of happens over and over and over again. Every time you do a TikTok, every time you do a LinkedIn post, every time you send a press release out, every time you send a newsletter out, you're quantifying your audience, honing your message, sending it out, analyzing, calibrating, and doing it again. And I suppose an awful lot of what we built and what we build on a daily basis is looking at where people are on that journey and how you can make that journey simple, easy, frictionless. Because the hard parts of storytelling are, like, one of the most devastating questions you can ask anybody is, what are you trying to achieve? Another devastating question is, imagine this was all over. What does success look like? And you can ask people these questions and they look at you, they have goldfish moments where they look at you with your mouth open. And you say, imagine if I took every crutch that was here away. And what happens to people with workflows is they lose themselves in busy work. So they go to the Excel spreadsheets or the bounced emails. And as opposed to being purposeful and impactful, they're being busy. And busy is a million light years from impactful or purposeful. And I suppose what we try and do in Media HQ is we look at the full breadth of the story circle. And we say, it doesn't matter if you're a comms director in a big PR agency or if you're in-house, what way can we help you through the steps of that journey to get the best impact? And is it to build the best audience? And it doesn't matter if you're sending a local press release out in a region in Ireland, you want to get it European-wide, or you want to hone a great press release. What can we put into the software? And the other thing I've realized is that, like, being a creative entrepreneur as well, software business is phenomenal in that, like, you know, with software now, we're at such an amazing time in the development of the world where anything is possible. You're only limited by your imagination.
You know, that brings me to something that I've been thinking about when it comes to the ever growing and ever the ever evolving world of technology. And, you know, it seems like the Media HQ is really trying to simplify things down so that people can really make a connection with their audience and engage with their audience. But obviously with technology and new platforms always kind of coming out, how do you kind of stay ahead of all of that? How do you make sure that, you know, you keep it simple rather than overcomplicating things by having, like, multiple strategies and having a different strategy for every single platform or every single new technology?
Yeah, and I think, look, there's a couple of points to that. I think the best organizations are mission driven. So they know why they exist. And it doesn't matter if it's, and, like, in the book that I wrote, The Magic Slice, I talk about being mission driven. And, look, you know, it doesn't matter if it's Red Bull, Marriott Hotels, Patagonia, brilliant company in Wales called Hyatt Denim. Everybody who works in your organization, from, it doesn't matter if it's a 2-person charity to a 500-person organization, people have to know what the mission is. So I suppose step number one is, like, what is the mission? What are you trying to achieve? And then I suppose step number two then is, what are the key focus areas for the work in the immediate future? So in the next 12-month period, okay, we know why we're here. We know what the greater good is. I love that story about, you know, after John F. Kennedy said, like, that the reason that they wanted to put a man on the moon, that if you visited NASA and you went to the toilets and there was somebody sweeping the toilets and you said to them, what's your job here? They'd say, I'm here to put a man on the moon. And that's how mission driven that they were. So I think it starts with a mission, and then it starts on focusing what the key aspects of the work are. In my first job as a shoe marketeer, my boss, I went in the first week and he had a stack of women's magazines on his desk. And I poked some fun at him for reading women's magazines. And he knocked the smile off my face pretty quickly. He said, "You'll be reading them soon." He said, "These people are our customers. We've got to understand how they think, what they read, and what they consume." And so I suppose that's the next bit then. The next bit to be successful is, where are my audience hanging out? So like, where am I going to get the biggest bang for my buck? So like, what am I going to do that's going to get the biggest return on investment? And like, I think the people who are most successful as communicators, they know the mission, they know the focus of the work. And I suppose they also know who the personas of the people they're communicating with are. Great communicators know what the dial looks like and they know where they need to move the needle on it. And I think if you know that stuff, then you've got a clarity of focus in how you need to execute. And you've got some set parameters in which you need to apply before you kind of hone your press release or your message or your social strategy to get the word out there.
You know, I want to go back to something that you mentioned, because you mentioned that you've written a book, Magic Size. So I'd love for you to just very quickly tell us a little bit about the book. Like, what inspired you to put pen to paper? I know you've talked about how you kind of, in your childhood and that kind of thing, you would write a lot of stories. But, you know, obviously writing something of nonfiction is very different. So what was the inspiration behind writing this book?
Like, it's funny, like, for as long as I can remember, I wanted to write a book. And one of my best friends on planet Earth is a writer. We were in college together. And I remember like being in our final year in college talking about like how we loved writing and what we wanted to write. And I was 23. So that would have been 1996. And from then up until when I finished the book in 2021, like, it would have nagged me all of the time. And when you have a hankering to write, it nags you all of the time. And I would have made a kind of a couple of failed attempts to try and do it. And, you know, like everybody else, lockdown came and I opened my computer one day and I opened a document and I called it The Last Attempt to Write the Book. And I knew that what I wanted to write was a book about storytelling for business. And a couple of years previously, I had written a pamphlet, and the pamphlet was called The Storyteller's Manifesto. And I knew there was something in it, because still to this day, even this week, like, I've got three requests online, one from India, one from San Diego, one from Sao Paulo. People, a teacher, an industrial designer, an engineer, who want to get a copy of The Storyteller's Manifesto. Because it doesn't matter what your career is or where you're at, the power to tell a story and to communicate with people, the currency and the power that storytelling brings is immense. So I suppose the pamphlet of the Storyteller's Manifesto was, you know, I was imbued by that and I was driven by that. And I suppose, look, like in the lockdown, everybody had, you know, a lot of time and nowhere to go. So that whole itch to get away from it wasn't there. You know, there was hours and hours to fill because there was no one to meet and nothing to do. And I wanted to write kind of the definitive book for me, on storytelling. I wanted to basically say, look, that's what I think of business storytelling, and that's what I have. And the magic slice comes from this moment, about 7 or 8 years ago, when we were hitting kind of a pivotal moment in Media HQ, where we were getting to the 100,000 story shared on the network, so that somebody was going to log in and be the 100,000th person to share a story and send it out through Media HQ. And I began to look through, there's a kind of a magic table on the back end of Media HQ where you can see all the stories that are shared by people, and you can see the interactions happening with them. So just before a journalist opens it, we can kind of see it kind of going out into the world. And I had a bit of an epiphany about what makes a story really successful and what makes a story tank. And the magic slice is two circles. One circle is what you want to talk about, and the other circle is what people are interested in. And the magic slice is that bit where they touch. And if you're really successful, the two of them become one circle, and sometimes they don't touch at all. And in the book, I talk about a number of different things. I talk about what storytelling is. I talk about the science behind storytelling. I talk about the structure and the form a story should take to be successful. And then I go through a 6-step process to identify how to find your magic slice. And we give some good cases and examples of brands that use storytelling every day and have a culture of storytelling. And like, it is really funny. I have a very good friend called Kira Lasty, who's a brilliant sports psychologist that I met on a project a few years ago. But she was a wonderful help throughout the project. She kind of sports psyched me through the project and kind of kept me on the straight and narrow. But writing is challenging, but very rewarding. And some people say, oh, I hated the process of writing the book. I quite liked it, I have to say. I like the focus. I like the clarity that it brought. And of all the things I've been involved in recent years, I got a huge buzz of satisfaction from the book and from the project.
I love that. And, you know, one of the things I'll make sure to do is I'm going to include a link to where you can buy the book in the show notes, so that if anybody's interested, they can just click on the link, check that out. I've already ordered my copy. Thankfully, you can grab it here in the US. So thankful for that. But I love like what you're kind of saying about the process that you went through there. And to kind of go back to the idea of like technologies and changing and that kind of thing, do you see anything changing about the process of like how you tell stories yourself, or how you imagine storytelling evolving in the future?
One of the brilliant things about storytelling as an art or a craft or as a cultural thing is that it's timeless. It's been there forever. And the earliest recorded incidents of storytelling are the cave paintings in France. And what are they, 30,000 years old at this stage? And the other amazing thing then is this thing of we're all hardwired for stories. And I run a storyteller course, and like one of the most powerful things you do on the storyteller course is we ask people to send us a photograph in advance of the course. We say, can you send us a personal photograph that you're willing to talk about? And lo and behold, you send us it in, and 3 weeks later, the day of the course comes, and at a random point in the day, your name pops up on the screen and you come to the top of the room. And I have a vivid memory of doing this for a large corporate a couple of years ago. And there was one woman in the room who was the admin for the group. So there was lots more senior people than her there. And her picture flashed up on the screen, and she came to the top of the room, and she was very nervous. And the black and white picture of very fresh and kind of bright, sprightly looking young couple in their 20s, dark hair, picture looked like it was from the 1950s. And she said, this is my nana and my grandpapa, back in the Netherlands. And she said, they're the reason that my family is prosperous and well today. And my grandpapa went down to work in the mines so that he could put all of his children through university. And she got very emotional. And people in the room got emotional. And people begin to realize in that kind of cathartic moment that this is their A game. And that this woman who people saw as an admin support for the team, they all began to see a different side of her. And that, you know, one of the most shocking kind of statistics is that if you put bullet points on a slide deck, 90% of them are forgotten in 30 seconds. So why would you bother? Like, why would you bother? And that actually bringing people on a journey through storytelling, and the things that are timeless in storytelling are, like, if you actually learn why is storytelling mind control? And storytelling is mind control because it triggers hormones in people. The great stories trigger hormones in people's brains. And in the book, we go through the types of hormones that create different reactions from people, and that the really expert storytellers know the type of stories to reach first. So if you want to build trust, you share and you open up and you're generous with how you share your emotions and about yourself. And that triggers the hormone, and that means that you trust me more. If you want to get people to focus and really listen, you trigger dopamine. And like a whodunit story, like, or something that's suspenseful, is brilliant for that. People tune in and they want to listen and they want to hear what happens next. And that's part of the magic of it. And I suppose, look, what's happening or what's changing in storytelling? Well, look, the biggest thing that's happened since this time last year has been ChatGPT. And I've seen some brilliant kind of use cases with ChatGPT where you can build all sorts of interesting strands within ChatGPT where you feed it knowledge and it kind of creatively engages with you and stuff as well. But I think the fundamental rules of storytelling are timeless. Like, and to tell a good story, you need to have a proper structure. You need to know the elements that are in the story. And if you do that, great stories cross oceans, to cross language barriers, they resonate with people.
So while the mediums may change, the actual core aspects of storytelling are consistent.
Yeah, and like, look, we're at that time of the year where people tune into stories for a whole host of different reasons. And I was talking to someone the other day about It's a Wonderful Life, movie shot in the 30s. It's just an unbelievable story. The animation, The Snowman. No talking. Would draw tears from a stone. And Steven Spielberg has this great line that, like, that the responsibility of the director is where to point the camera, and that as a storyteller you have this responsibility to, like, tell the story from a particular perspective. I was lucky enough a number of years ago to get commissioned by News Talk to tell a 10-minute story once a week. And the theme was media moments that shaped the world. And we did everything from the explosion of the space shuttle in America to JFK's assassination to, you know, a priest standing up in Dungarvan to say that there was a woman sleeping with people who had AIDS, to a plane hijack in Ireland, all a whole host of different stories. But part of the joy of the process was to tell a 10-minute story in three acts and to actually follow all of the rules. And one of my favorite stories in the series was, I always wanted to write a story about the novel 1984. And I kind of spent a few weeks thinking, okay, well, what perspective would I tell the story from in 10 minutes? And one of the fascinating things with storytelling is that, like, storytelling happens in three acts: beginning, a middle, and an end, first act, second act, final act. And that generally you're introduced to the hero or heroine, you find out their flaw, their need, they go on a journey, you know, they encounter strife, they will come to a turning point, you know, and they will, the turning point will decide where the journey goes, and then there will be a kind of a conclusion, and there will be a postscript and a kind of a lesson. And that's, you know, everything you watch on Netflix, everything you watch on Amazon Prime is that. But I was thinking about 1984 and how we tell the story, and I suppose the thing I, in my curiosity, thought about was, it's such an amazing and powerful book. I wonder who was the first person to read it. And I said, well, it must have been the publisher. So I found out who the publisher was, a guy called Eric Warburg. And I Googled first edition, 1984. And I could see that the publishing company was Secker and Warburg. And I found out where the address of it was in London. I also found out that Eric Warburg brought out a biography, and modern technology was reading that biography on my Kindle within 5 minutes, even though it, you know, came out in the 1960s, and found this amazing passage where he described what it was like reading the first edition of 1984, how it blew his mind, and the handwritten notes that he'd written in the margin. I put the address of the office into Google Maps. I found the street in London. I virtually walked up and down the street, and then I wrote a script where I was the post office person delivering the package, and he opened it up and he started reading it, and it blew his mind. And at the turning point at the end of the first act goes back then to how it came to be that this manuscript arrived on his desk. And at the end of the second act, we're back at the moment where he gets the manuscript, and then it tells the success of the book up to when George Orwell, Eric Blair, died. And that's a brilliant example of the rules that you apply in storytelling. Famous Irish comedian Hal Roach, whose catchphrase was, "It's the way I tell them." And it's crucial in storytelling. You have to obey the rules and have all the elements in it, and then it will really sing and resonate with your audience.
I love that. And, you mentioned Netflix, and just as soon as you mentioned that, one of the things I'm finding really joyful about, you know, streaming services right now is I feel like I'm being introduced to new stories that are still resonating with me, but I probably wouldn't have had the chance to ever see before previously. Like, you know, I mean, everybody's at this point heard of Squid Game, you know, for example, where it's like, hey, like, this comes from a totally different culture, totally different language, actors and scenery that we've never seen before, but it still touches a nerve for a lot of people. And it's almost like, hey, like, technology, rather than being something that changes the way that storytelling, the way that storytelling works, it's actually probably just offering greater visibility and greater opportunities for storytellers to tell their story.
And like, it was spot on. And like, it is this notion that, like, German drama, Danish drama, South Korean drama, it doesn't matter. Like, it doesn't matter what the native tongue is, in that, like, the story is amazing. And actually, you know, the funny thing is that, that was funny. Somebody popped up on the screen there. Did you see that?
Yeah. Yes, I did. Yeah. Sorry. I think they're dialing in early.
Is it?
Yeah. They're dialing in early. I'm meant to be catching up with him in a little while. Sorry. Do you want to go back to the start of what you were saying there?
So it doesn't matter. Like, South Korean, German, Danish drama, that, like, the language doesn't matter. And like, the other thing that's really ironic about all of that is, in the world in which we live in now, where digital distraction is everywhere, the beauty of watching a drama or a story not in your native tongue is that you have to concentrate. Someone said to me recently, God, yeah, why is it so much more relaxing to watch something that's not in your own language? Do you know why? Because you have to put your phone away, and actually you have to completely immerse yourself in the story. And the wave of calm and relaxation comes over you because you're completely enveloped and immersed in the story. And with streaming platforms now, that the world has become a much smaller place, and that we can all enjoy different genres. But at the heart of it all is, and the South Korean example is really good, is that just really good storytelling. Just really good storytelling. And any of the stories I have, or in the material I have, and I've given keynotes and presentations all over the world, the good stuff, it's as relevant in Bangalore as it is in Ballina. Like, it just, like, the stuff that's good, they are, themes that are understood all over the world.
I will say that is probably the first time that I've heard from Bangalore to Ballina before in my life. I really love that. That's fantastic. Well, listen, I wanted to kind of like finish us up because with just a little bit more, because like about you directly and like what you're hoping to achieve and where you hope Media HQ find success in the future. So I'd love to just ask you, like, what's your vision for the future of Media HQ? What does the next 12 months look like for you?
Yeah, I suppose, look, in the next 3 to 5 years, it's to be recognized as the number one, globally, to be the number one for media context and audience research. And I think we're well on the way there. We have, in the past 12 months, we've new products, new research. We have news desks all over Europe now. And we have some really cool stuff coming in the next 12 months. We have American news desks are being launched on the platform. We're launching a whole host of new podcasts on the platform as well. We have signaled our intention to build a database for North America. And we're looking at a couple of other projects for a number of European countries. And look, we're dedicated. Our mission in Media HQ is to help people to connect their story with their audiences. We've come a huge journey from a printed spiral bound book, from dealing with printers to dealing with, AI and data science. And look, I'm happy if people can come on. The success jobs in Media HQ are, can you build a list really quickly? Can you hone a message really quickly? Can you send it out and get an amazing report that tells you how it's resonating with your audience and who's reading it and who's not? And our job is to make that seamless, easy, and to take the pain out of it. And look, the success is that in the markets where we're successful, if you hear a news story in Ireland now, like 6 out of 10 of all of the news stories that are covered are shared using Media HQ. So we've had massive growth over the last 5 years. And for me, success is, North America, other territories in Europe. But at the heart of it, for a user, and it doesn't matter if they're a head of an in-house comms team or a client director in an agency, it's the ability to be able to give professional communicators the ability to do all of this work in a seamless, easy way that gets their story further, faster to more people, and gives them the gift of time in which to do all the higher jobs of, to answer that question of, what does success look like? What are we trying to achieve? What creative ideas do we need to inject into our communications to make sure that people love our stories? And like, even this year, like, if you told me a couple of years ago that we have an AI chat GPT prompt in the press releases now, that you answer 5 questions and it will write a version of the press release for you. And it wonderfully addresses that blank page effect for people. And look, I've written a book. I think I'm not a bad writer, but the ability of AI to generate newsworthy headlines, if you give it scraps of information, is unbelievable. So yeah, that's where our journey is going. And hugely excited by the power of technology, and hugely kind of energized about the potential of what AI can do for us.
Love that. And how can people find out more information about Media HQ and the work that you're doing?
Yeah, so mediahq.com, and you'll get a prompt to bang in an email there, and we'll happy to show you the platform. And from that point of view, I'd love to connect with people on LinkedIn. I have a large LinkedIn network, so you can find me on LinkedIn and connect with me there. And on Twitter, I'm Media Murray on Twitter as well. Twitter and LinkedIn are my social networks of choice. So yeah, that's how people can connect with me.
Love it. Well, I just want to thank you so much again for joining for the podcast. We'll make sure to link to the website, to your LinkedIn, and also, of course, to where you can buy the Magic Slice. Jack, thank you so much again.
No worries. Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for joining us for another inspiring episode of the Digital Irish Podcast. We hope you enjoyed the incredible stories of Irish trailblazers making waves around the world. If you find today's episode as captivating as we did, don't forget to hit that subscribe button on your favorite podcast platform. Stay in the loop for future episodes as we continue to unravel the journeys of Ireland's finest innovators. You can also connect with us at www.digitalirish.com. And a massive thank you to Jack Murray for joining on today's podcast and sharing his insights into storytelling and the inspiration behind Media HQ. We will be back again in just 2 weeks' time. Until then, thank you again for joining and see you soon.